This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 190 was recorded on October 24th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, which happens to be my own favorite podcast when it comes to quant and rules-based investing. Quadriga Asset Management CIO Diego Parrilla joins me as this week's feature interview guest. Diego has been getting a lot of attention for his anti-bubbles macro thesis, which we're going to discuss in full detail. Then we'll translate Diego's macro view to actionable trading strategies. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick and I will discuss the explosion of civil unrest which has occurred around the globe in the past week, and we'll also have a small chart book for extended precious metals market coverage.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, listeners, please note that we taped the show early this week, late morning Eastern time on Thursday, so our market wrap and post-game discussion will not be informed of Thursday's closing numbers. So, Eric, let's get to the S&P 500, which at the time of we're recording is just over 3,000. Keep edging towards those highs. Are we going to break out?
You know, it feels like it to me, and as I've said many times on this show, I think that's crazy. I think the fundamentals ought to be sending the market straight down, but I think it's the bad is the new good doctrine, where people are expecting more accommodation from the Fed, and they expect that to drive markets higher. Maybe that'll work for another round. I've been surprised before. Someday that narrative's going to fail, and it's going to fail hard, but it's not failing yet. The big macro risk, though, that I feel like almost everybody is mispricing right now is this explosion of civil unrest around the globe in the last week and the risk that it could come to the United States. And I do think that that's a much bigger possibility than most investors are considering right now. That's a long discussion, so let's save it for the post-game segment.
All right. Well, let's move on to the dollar index, which is finally getting a little bit of a bounce after a pretty ugly week last week. So what's going on with the dollar here?
Well, we've seen a very significant pullback from almost 99.50 down to 97. We haven't seen a daily close below 97 quite yet, although there were some right on the hairy edge of it. So I think this is still a healthy pullback given the news flow that we've had, the Fed announcing this QE that's not really QE thing that they're doing. There's plenty of reason for this pullback, and I still feel okay with it, but you know, it's kind of gone as far as I want to see it go. Looks like we're bouncing here off of 97. I'm hoping that we continue to bounce. If that rally fails and we end up seeing closing prints below 97, I'm going to get a little more concerned and start to think, maybe Luke Groman is being proven right sooner than I expected him to be. I've always known that Luke's dollar bearish view would triumph in the end. I just didn't think it was time yet, and I still don't. But a close below 97 would cause me to take pause.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. What's your take on the inventory numbers?
Well, crude oil inventories were a real roller coaster this week. API, the private data service, reported a 4.5 million barrel build on inventory, very bearish signal. And that would have been, if it had been confirmed by EIA, it would have been the sixth weekly build in a row. So a pretty long streak of builds there. It wasn't confirmed by EIA. EIA reported a drawdown of 1.7 million barrels, ending that five-week build streak. But Cushing, Oklahoma, still building 1.5 million barrels. That's a continuing trend in Cushing, and it reverses the previous trend. A lot of people, myself included, were concerned that the opening of two new pipelines was maybe going to drain Cushing out of most of its inventory. That doesn't seem to be happening. We are seeing a healthy replenishment of Cushing stocks, even in the face of nationwide builds. The big drawdowns, though, were in the finished products. Gasoline drawing down 3.1 million barrels, distillates drawing down 2.7 million barrels. So between big drawdowns in finished products and a modest drawdown in crude, that sent the tape up, up, and away. And in fact, it didn't even wait for inventory. I don't know if somebody had the data early or what, but a couple hours before the inventory data came out, the market was really marching higher. And of course, then that bullish inventory report accelerated the news to the upside. We got very easily to the 100-day moving average and even above it. That was at 55.65 on Wednesday. Looked like maybe that was going to contain it, but as we're speaking on Thursday, it's still early, before noon as we're recording this, we were all the way up to about 56.45, which happens to be the 5-month moving average. Earlier this morning, as we're speaking right now, we're just around the round number at $56. Is this rally failing here? It looks to me like maybe this is just a pullback, and we're probably headed up toward the 200-day moving average at 57.06. Might be over here, but I'm guessing that we're going to still see a little push higher. Fridays, just from a seasonality standpoint, Fridays are often up days for crude oil, so I wouldn't be surprised if by the time we close the week, we touch that 57.06 200-day moving average.
All right, well, let's move on to gold. I know we're going to discuss it a little bit more in the post game, but what's your thinking here in terms of the gold's consolidation at this 1500 level?
Well, gold continues to just impress me at every turn with its resilience. Every time we start to see the beginnings of a sell-off, and I think to myself, okay, the pullback that I've predicted based on overdone sentiment indicators and so forth is finally upon us. As soon as it gets started, something happens. And at the moment, it seems like fear associated with the upcoming Brexit vote is helping to push gold higher. Very strong day as of this morning. We're up quite a bit, kind of breaking out of a fairly flat consolidation pattern for the last week or so. You know, we're not to the point of a real breakout to the upside, but definitely it's time to reevaluate whether or not the pullback I've been expecting is really coming or not. So let's save the rest for postgame when we can go into some more detail with the chart book.
All right, well, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yield, which is hovering around 175 as we're recording. What's your thinking here on the next big move in interest rates?
Well, I do think we're going to go back and retest 150 again, but I'm a little more inclined to take profits at 150 if that's what happens, because it feels to me like we're really getting into a trading range here between 150 and 175, and are we really going to see that break lower than 150? I definitely think there's bearish fundamentals in the economy, but on the other hand, everyone's expecting the Fed to come riding to the rescue, and this current version of short-term QE that they've introduced is not designed to push long-term interest rates down. It's only designed to provide short-term liquidity. So that's not unto itself a reason to expect lower yields. So I think we'll see 150 again. I'll probably take profits on my long position, which is still open, just above break-even right now.
Okay, well, thanks for the update, Eric. Now, this week's featured interview guest is Diego Padilla. Now, why did we invite Diego to be on the show this week?
Diego is a really big picture macro thinker. He's got a great perspective. He's in Europe, which I think is important to get that European perspective, because obviously the situation with the changing of the guard at the ECB and so forth, it's a whole different dynamic that European asset managers are dealing with. And we haven't had a European fund manager as a feature interview in several weeks now. So it seemed overdue, and he's just a really smart guy, first time guest, and I'm really looking forward to having him on the show today. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. I did a full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, the host of this excellent podcast, back on September 7th, 2019. The download link is in your research roundup email. We discussed a number of key issues about the value of having a rules-based investment strategy in your portfolio. In our conversation, Niels shared some insights that may surprise you, especially when it comes to trend-following strategies not really operating the way some market commentators suggest they do. For more information, including a free book about trend following and the accredited investor slide deck from my interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, just go to toptradersunplugged.com/macro slides. Check them out. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Diego Padilla is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Diego Parrilla, a portfolio manager with Quadriga Asset Managers and a good friend and co-author with our good friend Daniel LaCalle. Daniel and Diego co-authored The Energy World is Flat, Opportunities from the End of Peak Oil, published in 2014. And Diego is the sole author of The Anti-Bubbles, Opportunities Heading into Lehman Squared and Gold's Perfect Storm. Diego prepared an excellent slide deck to accompany today's interview, and I strongly encourage you to download it. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not registered yet, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com and look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads next to Diego's picture. Diego, thanks so much for joining us. I want to go ahead and jump right in with the investment thesis that you focus your work around. Of course, you co-authored that book with Daniel LaCalle with respect to The Energy World is Flat, Opportunities from the End of Peak Oil. And your new book is called The Anti-Bubbles. Tell us what those are about.
Well, thanks, Eric. The Energy World is Flat presented a highly contrarian view of the world. I mean, we're looking at 2014. We have $120 oil. We had the consensus view of peak oil, which was looking at, say, $200. And there we came in with a thesis that was arguing for the flattening of the energy world, which had two major implications. One was the convergence across energies with big losers such as oil. And second, the convergence across regions, the globalization with big losers such as natural gas, or in this case, LNG. Now, the combination of these powerful forces through the flatteners effectively led to the variable convergence, the flattening of the energy world, which we argued, you know, $30 to $50 oil was a reasonable target that probably sounded like science fiction to a lot of people at the time. It didn't take too long for some of these flattening forces to take force, especially with OPEC sort of folding, and we saw what happened. So I guess that being a contrarian, being a bit of a chess player, being early in the game, identifying more forces. As an engineer, I do look at the world more as equilibriums, balances, forces. And sometimes you find these sort of big imbalances that, you know, it's a matter of when, not if, that things will happen. So some of these forces are more obvious. Some of them might be, you know, slow grinding. Some of them might be driven by paradigm shifts, like is obviously technology and other game changers. But eventually, it's a matter of when, not if, that these dynamics play out. And sometimes, you know, they turn out to show the emperor has no clothes. They're massive winners, massive losers in the process. So I found this process incredibly powerful. As I always say, I thought I knew it. And teaming up with Daniel was fantastic. He came in more from the energy equities world, perhaps, and me from the energy commodities. We tend to share views, but very often we also found ourselves looking at, you know, square and a circle, thinking, you know, this is what's going on. And turns out, you know, talking to each other, we're looking at a cylinder. So we're both correct. It really brought this perspective and the analysis and the views after finished the book to a different level. So I learned so much through that process that I kept that discipline of writing. I guess my brain, you know, looks for these sort of relationships. And yeah, the second book reflects this thinking. You know, it's a similar framework in the sense that, you know, I'm looking at imbalances, I'm looking at forces. And this time around, the book is more focused on the macro space. And it goes hand in hand with the strategies and the fund that I manage. But the common theme is we're looking at effectively a highly contrarian investment thesis that challenges the status of the world. And perhaps, you know, it might be a bit early, but, you know, the process is in both cases not only survived, but it's actually been reinforced. So in this sense, the second book, which is very relevant to today's world and dynamics, it's also bringing and coining the concept of the anti-bubble or anti-bubble potato, where which I think it could be very helpful for the listeners.
What is the anti-bubble? Please explain that concept.
Yeah, so perhaps it's best to start with the definition of a bubble. And I like to borrow George Soros's definition. He talks about bubbles as assets that are artificially expensive based on a belief that perhaps is very deeply entrenched in people's minds, but it happens to be false, what he calls a misconception. So we could debate at length today on whether, Bitcoin is going to change the world or not. It's out of scope. But certainly the belief that it might do can drive certain valuations. For other people, it might be a very different world. And to be honest, only time will tell. But to a certain extent, certainly beliefs can actually distort reality. So in that sense, the concept of the anti-bubble is born from a generalization of George Soros' framework. And perhaps the first dimension of the concept leads with the fact that misconceptions not only distort reality through artificially high prices, which we call bubbles, you could also have artificially low prices and valuations, which I define as the anti-bubble. So we're looking at effectively assets that are grossly artificially cheap based on a belief that happens to be false, where it's a matter of when, not if, that they will go up. Now, there's a second dimension that is important, and it is the fact that bubbles and anti-bubbles are somewhat like distorted mirror images of the same misconceptions. They're effectively two reflections of the exact same process. So by construction, once the misconception is understood and the bubble bursts, is the exact same catalyst and timing as the anti-bubble goes up, because they're effectively the exact same process. So I called it anti-bubble, a bit like an antivirus or an anti-missile. It's a defense mechanism against the bubble, as I say, which is pretty close to perfect hedge, because they're the same process. But there's also a third dimension that is relevant, and is the fact that these bubbles and anti-bubbles are also interrelated. There's some sort of a symbiotic relationship between them. They feed on each other. So if we look, for example, at what in my view are a clear bubble anti-bubble relationships, such as the S&P and the VIX, they're not independent processes. One might argue that some of the artificially high valuations in the S&P are partially driven by artificially low VIX, whether it's in the form of complacency, whether it's both for qualitative and quantitative reasons, which we can discuss in more detail. Either way, the interesting thing and the opportunity is that, or the ironic thing we could argue as well, is that nobody wants to buy puts in the S&P at 3,012 vol, yet everybody seems to be rushing to buy that insurance when the S&P is at 2,400 and the VIX is at 40. So in that sense, what we see is a great opportunity. In fact, the market is willing to give us the insurance the cheapest when we need it the most. There's an element here of risk premia, where we are being compensated for taking the other side of complacency and panic. So in that sense, the anti-bubble has these three dimensions of value, of hedge, and of risk premia, which effectively lead us to bring tremendous opportunities. There's a wider framework. And I guess the question here is, focus on the beliefs and focus on the misconceptions, because they are the ones that will actually give you the clue. And again, looking back and looking forward and what the opportunities might lie.
Diego, when I hear you talking about beliefs and misconceptions, what immediately comes to my mind is this notion, which a lot of people call the central bank put, the idea that, hey, no, it doesn't really matter what happens, what goes wrong, because the Fed's got our back. We've seen for the last 10 years, they're going to come riding to the rescue with more accommodative monetary policy. They're going to rescue the market. We don't need to be worrying about buying those puts that you're talking about on the S&P, because the Fed's got our back. I think this is got to be the greatest complacency bubble in the history of the world. Everybody's just convinced nothing can go wrong. And I think valuations are out of sight. Does that come into your thinking? And how does that play in?
Well, 100%. I would argue the central bank put is central to, it's perhaps one of the biggest beliefs, in my view, misconceptions that is effectively shaping, has been shaping in global markets for a long time. And linking it back to OPEC, for example, and the first book, there was this very widely held belief that, you know, in the OPEC book, I mean, you remember this idea that oil was perfectly, it would hold at such high prices because mommy and daddy, you know, Saudi and OPEC were infallible and full control, whereas the reality was quite different. I mean, at the end of the day, Saudi needs X dollars per barrel, you know, or they need, rather they need, let's say, $100 for fiscal and other big issues that they may need to finance. And whether that's produced with one barrel at 100 or two at 50 or four at 25, they still need that money. But nevertheless, there was this perception that they could just, you know, cut production and be fully in control, which obviously wasn't the case. In fact, this relationship, this meta-stable equilibrium breaks. And once it breaks, then it actually, you know, collapses, because then it sort of brings this race to the bottom. So I think, obviously, with the benefit of hindsight, that's pretty obvious. In the energy book, we were challenging that book and put, and in fact, we were looking at this as one of the sources of risk and game changers. I think we have a similar dynamic here. The central bank put, I would describe it as the belief, it might be a misconception, that you know, central banks and governments are infallible and full control, and they can print and borrow their way out of problems without any adverse consequences. Now, this is, I think, flawed. And it feeds into arguably two sub-beliefs that are very important. The first one is the belief that monetary policy has no limits. And the second one is the idea that fiscal policies have no limits. And we have seen this belief, you know, being played out. It takes many names. It takes, you know, never fight the Fed. It's Draghi's whatever it takes. It's PBOC in China is in control. We have seen the relentless bullying and financial bullying with, you know, not only playing by the rules, which, you know, I would argue that bringing interest rates to zero and to some extent QE and printing money was within the rules, but then actually breaking into what in my view is just one step too far, which is negative interest rates and what's to come in the form of helicopter money and other things that I believe we will certainly see. In fact, they're already happening. They just accelerate. And this central bank put, again, you mentioned, and we agree, it's central. And it has, I would argue, two main implications. The first one is complacency, the perception that there's no risk. But even if there was, don't worry, because if things go wrong, mommy and daddy will come and rescue us. But the second one is arguably even more dangerous, which is the financial bullying is, you know, in Europe, facing negative interest rates, we're literally being told we're pretty stupid, just holding, saving money or holding your cash. And this drives, I guess, a second wave, which is also critical in the process that might be even more complex and complicated because they feed on each other, which is what I would define as the complacent desperate search for yield.
Diego, as we talk about these complacencies and so forth, I think, as you said, a huge one is this idea that we can have negative interest rates. We haven't talked about modern monetary theory yet, but I think there's this desperate search for yield and this complacency that people don't think if they keep searching for yield that they're eventually going to introduce risk that's going to come back and bite them. So how does that factor into your whole thinking about all this?
This is very important. I guess the complacency and the financial bullying, and, you know, we've been incentivized or perhaps rather forced to take more risk. You know, we've been building the house to the roof. I mean, once upon a time, we would go to the market and say, hey, I want to take X amount of risk. How much do you pay me for it? We're in a situation now where we say, listen, I want my 5%. Tell me what I need to do, right? And what we've done is really take incremental risk in each and every single dimension you can think of. The first one, and perhaps critical, is term premia, is the bubble in duration, is fixed income government bonds, is lending for longer and longer for lower and lower yields. And we've seen, you know, 30-year bonds now negative. We've seen, obviously, this thirst for duration with 100-year Austrian bonds, a process that has been driven by this combination of thirst for yield and also artificially high demand from governments in the form of QE and others, benchmarks, etc. I would argue that this is the epicenter of the problem, but not the problem itself. Things go really start going wrong where effectively we go into the second dynamic, which is, you know, the credit risk premium. So obviously with negative yields in AAA bonds, we are going down the chain with perhaps investment grade, mass, high yield, and obviously emerging markets, lending to weaker and weaker credits for longer and longer for lower and lower yields, and creating what I think it's a major bubble across the spectrum, including high yield and zombies and everything else. This distortion of the fixed income market and credit markets leads into to the third wave, which is equity risk premium. The put-call parity relationship is broken with negative yields. You're discounting highly complacent expectations with artificially cheap interest rates, artificially low. You're looking at, you know, artificially low inflation. You're looking at so many things that impact buybacks, that impact the valuations, which lead us to investors wanting to capture the liquidity premium, which I would argue is kind of that fourth dimension, whether it's private equity with this hot potato of higher and higher valuations and more leverage, or private credit, where, you know, we have effectively shadow banking with lending all over the place, and disguised very often as fintech, you know, this cool word. But this is stuff that is happening of the system of unregulated and very dangerous. You know, liquidity, I think as we'll come back, is one of the major issues. We've seen already people gating. We've seen a lot of the issues with the repo and many other ways in which liquidity is a wider term, but is critical in what's to come. And then brings us to leverage. Of course, I want my 5%. You know, my mom used to earn that in Europe, her 5% with 1 year AAA and levered bonds not that long ago. Today, she'd have to go to triple Bs, 10, 15 years X time levered. So this process, if you add on top of that, what I think is effectively a case of gross mis-selling, these income strategies, you know, quote unquote, where people are selling short volatility strategies, you know, in multiple ways, disguised as income strategies. It's very different if I own a house in Miami and I rent it. What I collect is indeed income. But if I am selling hurricane insurance on your house, what I collect is not income, is insurance premium at the expense of insurance liability. So you have a Feb 2018 VIX hurricane come and people get completely wiped out. So what's happened here, the conclusion and these two forces, the central bank put and the desperate search for yield, are sort of feeding on each other. This complacency, this financial bullying, this desperation for yield are leading to what I would summarize as from risk-free interest to interest-free risk. You know, that nice little concept we have in the textbooks, R sub F, is now giving way to a world where we're literally doing insane things like locking in negative yields for incredible long times. So what is done is it's created, in my view, this series of parallel synchronous bubbles, which, you know, I would argue that after years and decades is taking us to a point where I would argue they're too big to fail. And this is effectively a new paradigm, which brings tremendous risks and I would argue also opportunities for investors.
And how do you translate, I mean, too big to fail, obviously, these institutions that are not allowed to fail, even when they should, because it's feared by regulators that they're too big to fail. Someday they are going to fail, and there's nothing that's going to be done about it. So when you say there's opportunities for investors, do you mean that you're speculating they will eventually fail, or are you talking about how to profit from the fact that regulators are likely to keep them propped up as long as they can?
Well, I would argue that obviously too big to fail takes different forms. You know, 2008, it was all about the banks. It was all about, you know, keeping the systemic risk of Lehman. It's almost a lose-lose, right? Or a win-win. I mean, you need to keep them alive, otherwise the system collapses. But if you keep them alive, then you're incentivizing the wrong behavior. But the reality is the too big to fail is now a much broader term. We're talking about China being too big to fail. We're talking about the duration bubble being too big to fail. We're talking about the zombies in Europe being too big to fail, which means you can't hike rates. We're talking about all these massive bubbles that we've built that go way and beyond institutions. It's, you know, that's where the Lehman squared, I would argue, is more like Lehman cubed in terms of the challenges that we're facing. And obviously, I think to me, the Q4 of fourth quarter of 2018 was an inflection point. I think this process of normalization of monetary policy, where there was a perception that, you know, after all these years of excess and low rates and QE and increased debt, we could just turn things around and normalize things. It became pretty clear to the Fed and the rest of the world that that's just not going to be possible. A lot of people forgot about this. It's not even a year ago, but we saw GE, amongst others, being on the brink of collapse with the implications it would have had. And I think the Fed realized that it was a lot closer. I mean, this increase in volatility, this increase in correlations, this increase in forced liquidation, which was starting to have an impact in liquidity, was pretty close to becoming a major liquidity event. We barely dodged the bullet and what could have been also a reflexive move. And I think what we are seeing today, again, I'm particularly worried, and I think China is a great example of what might come. But the reality with too big to fail is they simply cannot fail. And as a result, they will be transformed. So I think if I look at the macro picture, if I had to summarize it very quickly, I would argue that all these years of money printing and debt haven't really solved the problems. Okay, all we've done is it has delayed, enlarged, and to a certain extent transferred these problems across currency wars, bigger thy neighbor. Now, we are in a situation where all these dynamics, which are contagious, complacent, etc., have led to bubbles that are so large that we can't let them collapse. Therefore, we're going to see a very, very preemptive central banks all over the world sending rates to zero, including the Fed, effectively paving the way for massive fiscal expansion with expenditures and debts and MMTs that will never be paid back. I mean, will be effectively extended to maturity, there'll be whatever, but they'll be never paid back. And we have clearly a problem medium term, longer term of inflation. So we are now, the problem of bubbles are too big to fail effectively means that we are in the process of transforming these bubbles into inflation. Now, there's plenty of room for miscalculation here. There's plenty of risks. The losers are pretty obvious to some extent. But there are also anti-bubbles in the process. And there are also widow makers, to be honest. I would argue that number one of the rule of the investment game is that they will change the rules. So if you play the game thinking, oh, inflation is the end game, therefore rates will go up, I shoot short bonds, long bonds, I think you might find yourself in deep trouble because the new enemy is the bubbles, it's not inflation. So they're going to let, you know, inflation run it will also feed through the currency, which is what they want. But you're not going to see, the rules of the game are changing. And this, again, opens a complex world that is becoming increasingly polarized between extremes of either these bubbles completely implode into, you know, what would be catastrophic in terms of the potential size and impact, or we transform those into a different problem, which today inflation is seen as the lesser evil. I'm sure our grandparents would disagree. So in that sense, the damage is done. I think it would be foolish to think that, you know, everything that we've done is something you can just get out nicely. I mean, this is something that is compounding these problems, and it's extremely polarized and it's accelerating. And this, so yes, there's lots of risks, but there are also anti-bubbles and other opportunities in this framework. Although, as I always say, I hope I'm wrong because it's not a pretty picture.
Diego, as we take this, I, first of all, I couldn't agree more with you on this big picture. And I think, as you say, they're going to change the rules. They're going to take desperate measures in order to keep things propped up. And it's probably going to result in a whole bunch of government spending and a whole bunch of bond issuance and so forth. One of the conclusions that I come to is it's hard for me to see how gold doesn't benefit stupendously from this. And there's lots of ways this could go down, but it's hard for me to see how they bailed things out and changed the rules without eventually resulting in a major increase in the US dollar per ounce value of gold. I'm guessing that you agree with that from the title of your book, including Gold's Perfect Storm. Are we on the same page there? And how does that play into your thesis?
We're 100% on the same page. I think gold is sort of part of the checkmate of these dynamics. You know, there are very clear processes. I think it's worth discussing how we get to this checkmate and how it, it and, And I think China is a good example, right? So China is a country that operates under either a semi-open or semi-closed system. I mean, it does trade with the world, but it does it in a way where there's lots of rigidities on the exchange rate and monetary policy and other manipulations. So what's been happening is they know what they need to do. But in reality, every time they've faced a crisis, they've done three things. They've printed money, they've lent that money, and they've created implicit guarantees on people. So if you're about to bail out, whether you're a broker or a construction company, suddenly you're state-owned or whatever else. Now, this process, this money that has been printed and lent that can't leave the system, effectively finds its way like water into two main buckets, infrastructure and real estate, whether it's another bridge to nowhere or a ghost city or whatever. So you have this dynamic where all this monetary and fiscal abuse ends up a bit like Spain, where I'm originally from, finding its way to these bubbles. We're talking about, you know, real estate. And this is not my numbers. This is, you know, some of the main investment banks, over $40 trillion of real estate bubble. So I would argue this is definitely in the too big to fail category, because if you actually think about, okay, what would happen if these bubbles fail and what is the process? You think about, you know, the asset value is going down, the developers going down, your collateral at the bank, your wealth effect, the banking asset liabilities, the lending, etc. The house of cards collapses. So what's going to happen is, in the case of Spain, we have leftist countries like Podemos. I mean, China obviously has other issues. 3% of the wealth of the Chinese is in equities. Think about it. It's all brick. It's other forms of wealth. So if that shoe fell, this is pretty major. So it's not going to fall. But it's not going to fall because it shouldn't fall. It's not going to fall because they will keep those housing prices in yuan at artificially high. Now, that doesn't mean that those house prices will stay high in dollars or euros or yen or whatever. So the degree of freedom, and this is very, very important to understand, the way in which China blows up is through the currency front. So currency devaluation, manipulation, etc., which we're not talking about a small 5% move, we're talking about a major move. Effectively, it's more of the same. And you know, as a European, I would argue that part of the 2012 crisis came from the US QE in 2008, you know, sending the euro to 150, and along with it, the euro yuan, which with the Chinese currency was pegged. So as European, I have sympathy for Draghi, who walks into the office and say, hey, man, I need to defend myself. And Europe came in, and not only did QE in another form, it actually had to go way bigger and way farther with negative rates as part of this contagious process, which then led to China doing stuff in August 15 and January 16, et cetera, et cetera. So this circle eventually brings us to a situation where, why are we doing currency wars? What are the benefits and risks? And I think it's important to understand that there's obviously positives and negatives. The positives, well, start with the negatives. You have certain bubbles, you have inflation, because if the yuan is 20% weaker, then oil in yuan is 20% more expensive. Now, this is more than offset in the case of China by the benefits, which is, oh, I am a cheap labor, I'm a competitive, I'm a cheaper economy to produce. Therefore, people send their factories, they do the investment, the spending, the economic activity, the employment, etc. So China is balancing these two forces of the negatives of inflation and bubbles with the positives of other, until you get trade wars. Because trade wars is very critical, is the new phase, and is very much a defense mechanism against currency wars. We need to understand that when you have a bigger than neighbor, when someone is misbehaving and sending you the crisis in the way of cheaper, artificially cheaper production costs and whatever, at the end of the day, Mr. Trump, you know, whether you like him or not, he basically looks at this and says, hey, General Motors, I didn't bail you out so that you produce in China. I bailed you out so you produce in Chicago and Detroit. So you know what? By law, you're not going to be able to do this. And by the way, Apple, I know you don't owe me anything, but to be honest, if you want to produce 20% cheaper in China, I'm going to tariff you by 20%. So all trade wars are doing is neutralizing these currency wars. And the important thing to understand is that then the emperor has no clothes, because the economies that have been effectively trying to print and borrow their way out of the problems, they begging through beggar thy neighbor, find that they're left with the bubbles and the inflation, and they have no benefit. And then you have Venezuela, and then you have Argentina. So the flip between China from a perceived world power to a complete Ponzi, it might be more fragile than people think. And to some extent, it might fall by its own weight, or it might be triggered by some of these dynamics. So in this sense, going back to gold, if I look at the currencies around the world, and this is a marathon race, you would ask me, Diego, who's going to win the race or who's going to lose the race? I would think this is an easy call. I mean, I think gold will win the race, and people like Venezuela or Turkey or Argentina will lose the race. It is less clear to me whether, you know, the dollar, the euro, or the yen, how they will peg in this race. But my contrarian view, because believe it or not, it is a view that gold and the dollar are both up, happens to be a contrarian view. And it gives you opportunities also to structure trades with very, very attractive reward. So I do think gold will be a big winner. And it's a critical part of this process of printing and borrowing your way out and currency and trade wars.
Diego, I couldn't agree more with you on the big macro picture, but I know our listeners will thank me if I ask you to translate that now to portfolio construction. How do we take all of these big picture ideas and translate them to what to invest in?
Well, great question. I think Warren Buffett has two rules of investment. He often talks about don't lose money, and rule number two, don't forget rule number one, which sounds great and very wise, but I think it's somewhat cynical in the approach, because many of the long-only people will face very significant losses during a Lehman scenario or others. So I do agree with him that this is a game of capital preservation first and foremost. And I think what he means is you need to compound on that capital preservation. To some extent, cash might help you there in the short run, but I think there are much more efficient ways to do this. So let me, perhaps this is a global audience, but let me take an example using a portfolio as if it was a soccer team, a football team. And trust me, it has quite deep messages. The first point I would make, and this is for the listeners, just to reflect on, is many people think that investing is a game where, you know, you win by scoring goals. It's all about making money, right? I'm investing my money. I want to make money. I want to make capital gains. I want to make income gains. It's this mindset of striker. It's all about scoring goals. Whereas in reality, you know, whether it's the case in football or basketball or any sport, there's also a very important aspect of the game, which is playing defense. In fact, I think that in order to win, you must first not lose. And to me, it's all about capital preservation and compounding on that. So when you build a portfolio, then the first thing we need to be aware of is this, that some people might be playing by the wrong rules. We think that it's all about scoring goals. And as a result, we have 10 or even 11 strikers. So your equities, your credit, your high yield, your EM, your commodities, your private equity, private debt, venture, real estate, the whole lot is designed to go and make me money, right? So I think in that sense, you know, when you look at the team, there's some hidden risks, particularly one, which I define as the risk of false diversification. False diversification is confusing the fact that you have a lot of stuff in your portfolio. So I have some Argentina, some oil, some Amazon, whatever, thinking that I'm actually diversified, when in reality, it's all one trade, all one big trade. And I think, you know, we don't need to go that far. I would ask investors, and I'm not trying to be clever or anything. I'm just saying, hey, how did your portfolio do in the last quarter in 2018? How did you do? Were you as diversified as you thought you were? Were you running more risk than you thought? And the answer probably is that many have been caught into this perceived or artificial low volatility, which is perhaps the most important anti-bubble in the system, is, you know, an asset that is grossly artificially cheap, the volatility and the perception of risk, but also artificially low correlation. So you have a portfolio that for a while looks like it has no risk, low volatility, low correlation. But when things go wrong, you get volatility is going exponentially higher and correlations increasing to plus one or minus one, effectively resulting in exponential growth in value at risk and risk-adjusted measures. What it means is you have this forced liquidation, everybody has the same trade, and this compounds. So I think this is a major concern, and I would actually urge investors to look at their portfolios and watch carefully for that possibility of, you know, only strikers and looking at the false diversification. Now, if you look at the rest of the team, you know, going back, some people tell me, Diego, I have, you know, my defender is cash. And I would argue, keeping the football analogy, soccer analogy, is that cash is not really a defender. Cash is a striker in the bench. You know, you have money set aside, which you're holding there, waiting for the right opportunity to buy another striker. But it's not going to make you money necessarily. It's kind of there. And it works just like if you had a striker. If you live in there for a few matches, it's okay. You live it there for a few years, you're going to have a problem with inflation. And then we have what I call Beckenbauer, right? Those who are old enough and fluent enough in soccer will know he's one of the Michael Jordans, you know, one of those amazing footballers from Germany in the 70s, captain, great defender, and he has done effectively the German Bund, has been an incredible defender for the portfolio. But, you know, Franz Beckenbauer is now 73 years old. There's very limited room to, in my view, with already 30 years at deep negative rates, well, negative rates, that it will have a significant room for defending. And this is a major problem because this whole concept of 60-40 balanced portfolios, the idea that my equities, if they ever fall, my bonds are there with my 5% yield to protect me, in Europe is certainly not the case, neither in Japan. And the thought that rates are going to go to -5, I think is ludicrous. I think you will see 0 to -1 being the sweet spot of negative rates. I think Germany is more likely to borrow, you know, 5 trillion at -1 than 1 trillion at -5. So what it brings us, and I'm just compounding the problem and putting the perspective, is not only we're playing the game by the wrong rules, which is we think we win by scoring goals. We're playing with 11 strikers, by the way, many of them very expensive. This mindset that you win by having perhaps 11 Ronaldos, where that's not necessarily the case with cash that is suffering from long-term inflation and bonds that are suffering. Obviously in the US, and I think treasuries have a role to play, they're arguably one of the very few markets in the world that has, you know, AAA dollar and room to actually make gains in duration. So I think treasuries should play and have still room to play, but it actually urges, it creates the urge for us to find defenders, to find, to balance back those portfolios. And I do agree that gold has a big role to play, but I'd like to elaborate on a couple of more people that, you know, because this is about educating the listeners and the investors. And I think, again, I'm not in possession of the truth, but let's look at a piece of the puzzle that is generally viewed as a defender, which are trend followers, CTAs, right? And so very often it's understood, you know, they did well in 2008. But in the reality, if you actually ask yourself, okay, what position is the CTA playing in the pitch? What am I asking this guy to do? The reality is that we're basically telling the trend follower, hey, when I'm attacking, go and score all the goals for me. In fact, in a situation like today where markets, the trends have been very strong, where volatility is very low, effectively they're playing at the very top and they're all in and probably levered. But unfortunately, when the team counterattacks, what we're telling the players, listen, run really, really fast, put the gloves on and do all the saves. And then, by the way, when we attack again, go and run and score the goals for me. What sounds totally stupid in a football pitch somehow seems feasible for some people or rational in the portfolio. It is not. Some of these perceived defenders are not currently or defenders. In fact, they're pretty much the opposite. And I think this is important to understand because sometimes in the industry you have a lot of frustration with, okay, I bought this strategy. I thought I had a defender and turned out I had, you know, a guy in offside or red carded or whatever. So I think in that sense, the portfolio needs to look at strategies that are going to behave the way we expect them, the way they're meant to. And in that sense, I am the goalkeeper of the portfolio. I run a strategy that believes strongly in gold. It believes in treasuries. But perhaps the key asset that will provide very, very explosive and highly predictable payouts is financial insurance, is options. And here, I think, you know, there's tremendous opportunities to achieve what I would argue is almost the holy grail, which is artificially cheap premium with very low carry, potentially even positive, and very explosive returns when you need them. And this is part of the construction that I would look at. Clearly, you know, before we get perhaps into some trade examples, if you're interested, I would just complete the picture by saying, be careful with credit. Credit is an asset class that in this end game where we are either going into a major blow up or inflation, unfortunately, credit is going to do bad in both. You will lose if there's a big credit event, but I really don't know what your, you know, 94 euros will buy you in 30 years, or you know what your with inflation kicking in. So that those gains, those principal repayments that you will get in a long time with inflation, I think they're not going to do that much. So if you're going to play with strikers, I think selectively equities will do better, at least in an inflation scenario. I think real assets like real estate, whilst they might look quite expensive, I think they have a role to play more in the midfield. But certainly my focus and what I do is goalkeeping. And in particular, I think these three assets, gold, treasuries, and financial insurance, have a lot of value to add.
Diego, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. Unfortunately, in the interest of time, I'm not going to be able to take you up on your offer to get into specific trade examples. But for the benefit of our listeners who may want to follow up with you and learn more about what you do at Quadriga Asset Management, please tell us, first of all, what business you're in and how people can contact you.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been a pleasure. Sure, I'm a portfolio manager. I run a series of strategies. I'm the goalkeeper. We have an offshore strategy with daily liquidity, and which has been has the support from large institutional investors. We are in advanced discussions and process to launch also a U.S. onshore solution. So in that sense, what we do is differentiated in the way it's constructed and likely to perform. And it uses those building blocks I discussed. It's precious metals, it's treasuries and financial insurance. I'm reachable directly on my email, perhaps easier for people to look me up in Twitter, and then I can link them up. I am at Parrilla Diego, double R, double L. And at Quadriga is diego.parrilla at quadrigafunds.es. Once again, Parrilla, double R, double L. It'd be my pleasure. We don't run retail strategies. We work at the accredited level, but certainly very happy to continue the dialogue and the education, hopefully preventing some mistakes or you know, potential accidents, and hopefully contributing to creating those large returns when we need them. So thank you again for the opportunity, and I look forward to continuing the dialogue.
Okay, and for the benefit of the accredited investors in our audience who are qualified to invest in your funds, what is the Twitter handle and email address?
Twitter is at Parrilla Diego. That's P-A-R-R-I-L-L-A Diego, D-I-E-G-O. That's my Twitter, and my email address is diego.parrilla at quadrigafunds.es.
Well, thanks so much for a great interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests at macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag at macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, that was a great interview. I really enjoyed the way Diego used the analogies towards sports and this idea of a lot of people are looking for diversification through having a whole bunch of strikers. I like the way he put that. And truth is, you have to build a portfolio that actually can play defense. The problem, I guess, until about last year, having a whole bunch of defense in your portfolio really forced your portfolio to underperform. But in the last year, treasury bonds and gold and things like this have actually been doing well. What is interesting, though, is that he did mention options, and particularly the idea of using options as a way to build these asymmetric trades to build hedges in there. And that's definitely something that I always find, or at least I have a lot of passion in doing. But it was really good. I really enjoyed the interview. Anyway, moving on, though, you did want to talk a bit about the civil unrest and what's happening, and you had some ideas. So what was on your mind, Eric?
Well, there's been an absolute explosion of civil unrest around the world in the last week. In Chile, there were massive, massive protests, riots. I think it was 38 subway stations that were burned beyond recognition by people who were supposedly upset about a 30 Chilean peso, that's 4 cents U.S., less than a nickel, increase in subway fares. And I think there's a common trend here. You look at the situation in Hong Kong, and we're up to something like 20 weeks of protests that have turned violent in Hong Kong as well. Well, the Hong Kong situation was brought about by this extradition bill, which has now been formally rescinded and withdrawn. But that's not causing the protests to stop. And I think that what we're seeing is these things are straws that broke camels' backs. Really, the situation in Hong Kong is about the fact that Hong Kongers don't trust China to honor the 2047 treaty date for fully absorbing Hong Kong into Chinese culture. They're afraid that Hong Kong is going to be annexed before that, and the extradition bill was just one particular straw that broke that camel's back. Similarly, in Chile, I think what happened there, this tiny little 30 peso increase in subway fares, was really something that just broke the back of a population that was very, very frustrated and unhappy about what they perceive to be extreme social inequality. They don't like the fact that President Piñera is a rich guy. And frankly, I'm not sure that there's a whole lot of logic there, but there's a lot of people who are very upset. And we're seeing these trends all around the world. And the things that they share in common are that it seems like it's very slow at first, and then all of a sudden, all at once, there's an explosion of violence and mayhem and crazy stuff going on. Well, most Americans are in the habit of saying, yeah, but that's crazy stuff goes on in other countries. It never happens. It's not going to happen here. Well, consider the fact that in just a few weeks, President Trump is either going to be impeached, or I should say the House of Representatives will either vote to impeach President Trump and send that impeachment bill to the Senate. If that happens, it is going to cause the most ardent Trump supporters to go absolutely bonkers. They're going to interpret that as the deep state trying to undermine the president of the United States and remove him unjustly from office. They're going to, or at least some of them are going to see it as their patriotic duty to their country to take up arms and fight a civil war. You're going to have a group on the other side, if it goes the other way, and if let's say the Supreme Court says, no, this is illegal, you can't have this impeachment inquiry, some judge votes it down and says you can't do that, it's not allowed. That's going to result in the other side, the anti-fascist action group, going absolutely berserk. It's a setup as this impeachment inquisition comes to a head in the next few weeks for one large group of people or another to get very, very upset. And I think that there is a very real risk that that could suddenly mushroom into violent riots all across the country, just as nobody expected a 30 peso increase in Chilean subway fares to cause people to burn 38 subway stations to the ground almost. Crazy things happen all of the sudden when people get to the point where they lose their cool. And I think there's a perfect setup in the United States for that to happen. Now, I'm not predicting that that's going to happen. I'm not saying that that's the most likely outcome, but I think it's a very real risk, and it's one that very few investors seem to be taking seriously. So I think in the next few weeks, we need to watch that situation very carefully, as well as what happens around the rest of the world. In the case of Chile, for example, the increase in subway fares, the the president of Chile already announced that that's going to be withdrawn. But that hasn't stopped the rioting and protests. And there's a tremendous amount of looting going on. People, you know, they're upset by what they consider to be social injustice. And in their mind, they're justified when they go and steal that widescreen TV set from a store. They perceive the store owner as being corrupt or the government as being corrupt or whatever. You've got a lot of people doing a lot of crazy things who feel entitled to be doing so. They don't think of themselves as doing criminal acts when they're looting stores in Chile or burning stores down in Hong Kong. These situations are all a reflection of a growing global wealth inequality dissatisfaction. And I think that it's going to come to a head, if not over this impeachment inquisition, there will be something else, and eventually we'll see it in the United States as well. So I think that's a very important risk that investors need to take seriously. But Patrick, on a more upbeat note, let's talk about precious metals, because as much as I felt like, hey, if you looked at that Commitment of Traders report just a few weeks ago, it was at all-time record speculative long interest. That was a real setup. If you look statistically at other times that that condition has existed, it's very frequently been a setup for a major downside correction. Not only have we not seen that downside correction, but boy, gold is looking awfully strong right now. Now, I think that it's the Brexit vote coming up that's helping to buoy the price, but we haven't seen it. And meanwhile, that huge, huge record sentiment indicator is off by about 25% from its record highs. So I'm starting to think maybe what we're going to see is a further extended sideways consolidation to allow that sentiment extreme to wear out of the system before precious metals actually move higher. And Patrick, I should mention for our listeners who are not old-time regulars, you can find the download link for the post-game chart book that we're about to discuss in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com and click the red button that says looking for the downloads.
All right. So, Erica, what I wanted to do is just give a little context on your comments. And so on pages 2 and 3, I just have the standard daily charts of the gold and silver markets. And one thing that I've been sharing with a lot of my members is, at least I've been more or less skeptical that gold was, if we're assuming that gold is in a bull market, I was skeptical that we would have a pullback as deep as 1350 or deeper, because I think that one of the things that causes a gold market to be a bull market is everyone's got to be chasing. And I think that if gold pulled back to 1350, giving an amazing opportunity for everyone to buy the dip at a perfect moment, it would just be too easy. And I would argue that if we got down to 1350, maybe it's not even a gold bull market. Maybe we're going to even have a deeper pullback than that. And so, to be honest, the fact that we've consolidated up here and haven't even printed 1450 on a pullback is actually relatively bullish. Now, we have not had the breakout yet, so I don't want to already be rah-rahing the next leg higher in gold. But so far, the fact that we've spent several months consolidating gold with being a very shallow consolidation, I interpret that very bullishly. And even silver's pullback has been just a more or less a 50% retrace of its entire leg higher. And considering the magnitude of the spike that we saw in August, this type of a deeper pullback in silver was a little more expected. But where I want to move on, though, is talk about those Commitment of Trader reports on pages 4 and 5, because you were referencing that. And that's a measure of looking at commercial hedgers, large speculators and small speculators, how they're positioned in the futures markets. And you were commenting on that oversized positioning on the long side of speculators. And while it does look pretty significant in terms of how large the position is, and so I want to reference here on the Commitment of Trader reports the way Adam Collins puts it out. And what he does is he shows it as a 5-year percentile of the net position on the Commitment of Trader reports adjusted for open interest. And this more accurately normalizes those caught reports. And what's interesting is that the at least from a commercial hedging perspective, we have not seen any major extreme in the last month. I mean, we're more or less like at 57% on that 5-year percentile right now. And so while the large speculators are definitely bullishly positioned, we have not seen any major extremes on the positioning of the commercial hedgers, which I think is in itself a bit of a clue that, that maybe we're not yet at major, major extremes like it may appear on the surface.
Patrick, this mirrors the feeling that I've had, which is, you know, that extreme in sentiment is definitely a setup for some kind of pullback, but that can be resolved either of two ways. It can either be resolved by a sustained consolidation, which allows the extreme to bleed off, or it can happen in a snapback where everybody freaks out and panics at once. Nobody's freaking out and panicking, and we've seen this consolidation continue for a few months now. So, you know, the old saying, the longer you base, the higher in space. If we end up breaking out of the current consolidation to the upside without ever going, say, below 1450, on the one hand, well, too bad for those of us that were waiting for that pullback to 1400. But on the positive note, that's a really bullish sign. The fact that we could have moved as far as we did and get out of it with just a sideways consolidation as opposed to a really significant pullback, if that happens, that's a big if. We don't know that yet. But if it goes that way and we end up breaking to new all-time highs, you know, we get to 1600 in gold and without ever having gone below 1450, it just adds even more strength to my long-term bullish conviction that gold is headed much, much higher in coming years.
Now, Eric, the one interesting thing that I would offer you as a consideration, and I'm going to be talking about it at the Silver and Gold Summit during a number of the presentations, is that for gold, because of its contango and the forward price being higher, it actually translates into a really interesting options market. More importantly, there's also a natural skew in the gold market, a right-tailed skew in the option series. This allows you to actually get some very cheap hedges into gold and be able to offset a lot of those cheap hedges quite far out of the money with some option rights. And so it allows you to actually take a very decisive long position in gold here. And even if we are proven early and that pullback to 1350 happens, that I don't think will, but let's say it does happen, you can actually have hedged out a lot of that and still be long gold here today. And so I actually think that anyone who wants to be long gold, the options market gives you lots of ways to manage the risk and be in the position today.
Patrick, I know you're speaking in San Francisco this weekend, October 27th and 28th at the Gold and Silver Summit. Are you going to be covering those hedging strategies and how to get into a protected long position in gold that hedges downside risk?
Absolutely. So I'm going to be covering all of that. So anyone that can make it out to that Silver and Gold Summit, do so. If you do register online, if you use the Macro50 promo code, you can get 50% off. I'm going to also be speaking on a panel with some of our all-stars like Brent Johnson and Grant Williams will be on there. And Marin Katusa is going to be moderating it. So it's going to be a great session. Looking forward to seeing so many of our Macro Voice listeners out there.
And again, that's at the Hyatt in San Francisco this weekend. Today's episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Be sure to check out my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen, published on September 7th, 2019. The link is in your Research Roundup email. And for those of you who haven't registered yet to get that Research Roundup email, please be sure to go to our homepage where you can do so. The benefit to you is you'll receive that list of download links every single week, which provides access to the download materials associated with our own interviews, as well as the best investment research that we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book to accompany Diego's presentation, as well as the charts we discussed in the postgame. There's also a link to an interesting article discussing Robert Shiller's view that a recession is likely years away due to the bullish Trump effect, as well as an article about Bank of America declaring the end of the 60-40 standard portfolio. You'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we will include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account, @MacroVoices, for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter, @EricSTownsend, and myself, @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.